so on and so forth.
Here in the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Frank Warren. I need to remind everyone that you can listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone simply by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. My guest tonight, Frank Warren, is a longtime ufology researcher who is always a welcome guest on the Eye to the Sky program. Frank is the owner and editor of the UFO Chronicles website. The UFO Chronicles website has info that covers the latest events, news, and happenings in ufology. There are many insightful articles and editorials on the site by several well-known researchers, including Frank Warren himself. I highly recommend that you save the UFO Chronicle website to your list of favorites and check the site often to keep up on the latest happenings and news in the area of UFO research. I love the topics and discussions that Frank and I get into when he is a guest, and I'm pleased to be able to welcome him back to the podcast tonight. And welcome, Frank.
Well, thanks, Dee. It's always a pleasure to be on Eye to the Sky and, of course, the UPRN radio network. I'd like to give a shout-out to New Orleans in particular, our listeners there, and also all around the world since we're streaming live. And I'd like to say hi to everybody in the B-Room.
Oh, yes, our virtual auditorium. A great bunch of people. Frank, one of the things that I'd like to kind of touch bases with you on is this, and don't ask me to pronounce any of these names because I just am, my tongue just does not work its way around Russian. But there's this Russian government official who is being bashed for coming forward with his contact experience. And that can be found on the Space Daily website for those of our listeners who'd like to follow along with us. The title of this article is Russian Regional Chief Under Fire for Meeting Aliens. I'm hoping you've read this and is just as amazed with it as I am.
Well, I've looked into it mildly, and quite frankly, that kind of swung far right on my dung heap meter, and here's why. First off, and again, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you want to look at this, when these things come up, you know, we need to look into them. They have to be investigated somewhat or thoroughly, depending on how far it gets. But from what I can see so far, is that the original source of the story was equivalent to a Russian tabloid, and my understanding was it wasn't a Russian official to begin with. He made an inquiry based on another story by the fellow that runs the chess federation deal. I forget the exact acronym, but it seems a little fishy to me. I'm obviously very skeptical, and I think you have to consider the sources in this. Now, that's where it sits so far. That doesn't mean we just throw it, you know, you throw the baby out with the bathwater. It does need to be looked into further. I've only mildly looked into it, and, you know, the first thing that comes back was the source, and it seems that the story was regurgitated many times. So you've got to you know, peel back the layers like peeling back an onion and get to the source of the thing and then find out really, you know, what went on. Kind of harkens back to the UN story that, you know, that came out a few months
ago. Oh, yes.
So I'm ultra skeptical in this particular situation. I really, personally, off the cuff, I don't think there's a lot to it. I got a feeling that, you know, like I say, it kind of swings right on the dung heap meter, to be polite. But it does, you know, we have to look into it and see what's going on.
Well, the individual in question, and I'm not even going to try and pronounce this individual's name. The first name is, I believe, pronounced Kirsan, K-I-R-S-A-N. And like I said, I'm not even going to try and pronounce the last name. He's supposedly the head of the Buddhist Kamaika region of southern Russia and president of the World Chess Federation.
That's what I was looking for, yeah, Chess Federation. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, we'll have to dig into it and see what else we can come up with if check out the background on this a little more.
Well, what happens in these instances is, you know, what's been going on in the last few days, this story gets out on the wire, and then it just gets regurgitated over and over again. What I was trying to do today before we went on the air was get down to the actual Russian source. What I could see so far is it looks as if it originated from a tabloid source in Russia. So that raises the hackles right off the bat. But again, you know, everything, you know, you got to look into it. We don't know for sure, although I'm very, very skeptical if this is anything serious, but we'll see.
Okay, I agree with you on that 100%, actually. And another thing I'd like to touch on with you is not only Stephen Bassett's X conference, which is going on this weekend, but also the contactees conference he's trying to put together.
Well, you know, I've got mixed feelings. One thing that I've always said about ufology in general is that it needs an agent. Our biggest battle with ufology publicly is with the media, and it's with mainstream science. If we don't... If we're not cognizant of how we look in regards to the mainstream media and or mainstream science, and bear in mind, and keyword look, our appearance, how ufology is presented, we're never going to get their attention, and that's the biggest battle that we've faced. That's been the battle for the last 60 years. And remember, in the very beginning, with what we deem modern day ufology, we did have the media's attention. I mean, UFOs were on the front page of every newspaper in this country and around, in many around the world, you know, from the birth of modern-day ufology in 1947. It wasn't until a few years after, when there was a concerted effort to start debunking this phenomenon, that it started going to the back pages, and then it's kind of a generational thing, you know, where it becomes fodder for mainstream journalists, etc. So anytime, I think as anybody that's promoting an event or a symposium or anything like that, you have to become as scientific as you possibly can. Now, and I separate the contactee phenomenon, you know, from the UFO phenomenon, and I think it should be separated. And quite frankly, one of the other things that always irks me is when there's a conference of some sort, and I'm not talking about the X conference this weekend, but just conferences in general, when all these things are lumped in together, all various phenomena, you know, Bigfoot or ghosts or, you know, other paranormal activity or what have you, and I choke on the word paranormal. We have a tough enough time with ufology by itself. We don't need to put these things in together, because inadvertently what happens is the media just gets a big laugh out of it. And we shoot ourselves in the foot when we do that. I think Bassett has got a hold of he's got a tiger by the tail in one sense, and I think there's great opportunity with what he's doing. He just has to have tighter reins on it. I really don't think that you just ask anyone to attend the X conference, or for that matter, any symposium or conference that you want to be taken seriously. Dick Haynes comes to mind with NARCAP, the National, what's the acronym? National Aviation Research on Aerophenomena. He distances himself from ufology in general, because he wants his organization to be taken seriously. And, of course, one of the best reports that you'll see in a long time is the 100-plus page report that was done on O'Hare. But you don't see, I mean, Dick Haynes is standoffish. He does not want to be associated in the same breath with what we could call mainstream ufology, if that's not an oxymoron in itself. But do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, definitely. I've had Ted Rowe from the same organization as a guest on my program, and he feels the same way.
We've got we have this circus atmosphere, and consequently, we create our own problems, is what it boils down to. I often think, it kind of harkens back to the day of Blue Book. One of the advantages of having the Air Force investigating ufology at the time, up in 1969, is it lent credence to the phenomenon. And a lot of mainstream scientists weren't afraid of crossing that line and discussing it. I mean, let's face it, the government, the military was looking into this. Why can't we talk about it? So, I always envisioned the smoke-filled room with the colonels and the generals and the whatnot talking about the UFO problem and the public's reaction to it, and them thinking, well, my God, what are we going to do? How do we do this? The public's going crazy with this thing. We've got to figure something out. And I often think of some kid in the background going, well, why don't we just get out of the UFO business altogether? And, so we don't endorse it. And then all the generals and colonels in the smoke-filled room, chomping on their cigars go, who is that kid? Now, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Then the next thing you know, they're out of the UFO business. They're not endorsing it anymore. And then we sit and fight amongst ourselves, which is the other part about it. So, the kid comes back and says, let these guys argue amongst themselves. They do enough damage for themselves. We don't have to debunk anything. And lo and behold, that's the way it's been since 1969. So there's no cohesion in ufology today, unfortunately.
I have to agree with that 100%. There's so much infighting, not just between individual groups, but individual researchers as well.
Well, Rich Dolan, I forget. I think it was, he was on another show that I was listening to, and God bless him for this, because he just nailed it, hit the nail right on the head. Somebody posed the question about the state of ufology or whatever, and he says, what ufology? He said, is there really such a thing? He said, in essence, the synopsis was, well, we've got, at best, we've got a few factions, and they don't work with each other. And, of course, the first thing that came to mind was MUFON. He says, but there's smaller groups, and then there's talking heads, there's regular symposiums, and, there's a couple of things going around the globe. He says, but, is there really a ufology? And I thought, that's a great question. Is there really a ufology? There's no cohesion. We don't work with each other. There's a lot of talking heads that are at odds with each other oftentimes. There doesn't seem to be a common goal. There isn't a melting pot where we share information. And he raised a good point, I thought, at that time.
I agree. It is so disjointed, so to speak. And like you say, everybody, nobody wants to work with anybody else because this is my research. You can't have it type attitudes.
Go ahead. Oh, no, fine. I'll wait for you. Ladies first.
Oh, well, thank you. I was just going to let you know that we have a question already from our virtual auditorium for you. This is from Skymon, and he says, I used to think the Turkey UFO case was not believable until I found out that not only was Roger Lear a first-hand eyewitness, but the state-sponsored observatory and space research investigation found it still unexplained and not a hoax. Furthermore, the dogs are clearly going crazy. How can you explain that?
Repeat that again, please.
Okay. He said,
sorry.
Oh, that's all right. He says, I used to think the Turkey UFO case was not believable until I found out that not only was Roger Lear a first-hand eyewitness, but the state-sponsored observatory and space research investigation found it still unexplained and not a hoax. Furthermore, the dogs are clearly going crazy. How can you explain that? I know the video he's talking about, and yes, you can hear a bunch of dogs just, whining and barking and just all upset during the filming of this video.
You know, right off the top, I'm not familiar with that particular case. Quite frankly, I probably am, but that's not ringing a bell specifically. However, generally speaking, you have the preponderance of all the evidence. A video in my mind, which so many people think, my God, the video evidence is great, it's a smoking gun, I don't feel that way at all, particularly if it's by itself. Often, what we see today, a video comes and somebody uploads or somebody's out filming, they're at the beach or whatever, they film something, they upload it to their computer, and bam, there's a UFO. They didn't see it, something's captured, and whatnot. At the end of the day, a video by itself is just that. Now, to go back to the other thing, he was saying that an organization that has looked into it has come to the conclusion that it's still unexplainable, i.e., not explained by conventional means. Lear was a witness, etc. The more eyewitnesses that you can attach to a case and or other evidence in terms of the pot of the preponderance of evidence, the stronger the case gets. In any case, whether it be the Turkey case or any case whatsoever. In fact, earlier today we were having a conversation with the paranormal phenomena that's going on up in Oregon with whom we've become who's become known as Oregon Bob. There's so many witnesses that are starting to go public with that. It just adds to the preponderance of evidence. In addition to the fact that there's also video, and there's been interaction, there's been effects on electronic equipment, etc. So the more the larger the preponderance of evidence, the stronger the case gets. You could actually take that out of ufology. I mean, that would hold true for anything, a court case, you could look at that scientifically or just generically in terms of a case relating just to the law, for example.
He added a little bit more onto this question as we were speaking. He says, furthermore, the 2009 event showed four orbs similar to the Phoenix Lights, and also that there were 12 other witnesses. So I've seen the video, or one of the videos anyway. From what I understand, this individual has seen this object several times and has videotaped it. Well, either the same object returning or identical objects going.
What was the first part in relationship to the Phoenix Lights?
The original event happened in 2009, and during this event, four orbs similar to the Phoenix Lights were accompanying this craft.
I see. Interesting. Well, of course, the orb phenomenon is unique in itself. In regards to the Phoenix Lights case, of course, large V-shaped craft, That was actually seen all across the country in the month of March 1997, and then there's been other instances where a large V-shaped craft has been sighted, and sometimes where it just looks, rather than people seeing the craft, well, very much like the night of the Phoenix Lights. Many people just saw what they assumed to be orbs. Some people, in a V-shape, other people actually saw the craft. There were, in fact, separate orb phenomenon along with the craft. So there's a lot of commonalities in these UFO sightings. And perhaps this Turkey case is one of them. Same thing with Stephenville, the commonality with the propulsion, or what apparently the propulsion system that Steve Allen saw. When he saw the white lights turn red, that also happened with the Phoenix Lights. There's a lot of commonalities with the sightings, say, within the last 20, 30 years, with orb sightings and large V-shaped craft sightings and that kind of thing.
Just kind of following a little bit of the conversation going in the virtual auditorium, and it's kind of turn to Chinese lanterns, the question was, are Chinese lanterns a physical object? Well, yes, they are. They're basically as simple as a garbage bag with a candle underneath it, the same principle as a hot air balloon.
Well, and with that said, it's important to put the emphasis on the fact that, the majority of UFO sightings after investigation, the ratio, is the same that it's been, since the beginning. After a proper investigation, the majority of UFO sightings can be explained. It's that smaller percentage that we're all interested in that defies conventional explanation that needs to be explored. We had a rash of UFO sightings over in the UK, and the majority of those were, in fact, Chinese lanterns. Apparently, they don't have the same stringent laws that we have here. We've had the balloon flare hoaxes go on here in this country. And to me, that happened, the sighting in 2008 in your area, Dee, where they actually found the guy. The guy finally admitted doing it, launching flares with helium balloons. And, I think they ought to. The same thing happened on that episode, or actually, I don't think it was on the UFO Hunters, but I believe Bill Burns commented on it. It was a hoax that those two guys did back east. These people need to be arrested. For God's sakes, you're launching an incendiary in the air, not knowing where it's going to land. It's just it's a fire hazard and it's dangerous. And they get their jollies out of that. And I think there should be consequences.
Not to mention, if I remember correctly, that guy here in the Phoenix area launched it not too far from the Deer Valley Airport, which that airport happens to be a much busier airport than Sky Harbor. There's several flight schools there, and I used to work literally across the street from the place, and there's airplanes taking off 24/7 from that place.
Well, which makes it, that even carries it to another level. I'm thinking of catching something on fire. This literally is putting air traffic in danger. So, the penalty should be much more severe than what they are now, so this kind of thing stops. But, once again, this often, I remember hearing the 911 tapes to that specific incident, I think in 2008, of the flares. And people were bewildered. Oh my God, it's a UFO. You could hear the adrenaline in a lot of the people that were calling in. And of course, if you launch three, flares via helium balloons, there's 90% of the time you're going to see some sort of triangular pattern. And this is what people were reporting. But again, the the emphasis is the fact that the majority of UFO sightings can be explained at the end of the day with, you know, with proper investigation. It's that smaller percentage that that always gets us, that should be explored.
Okay, here's another question from Skymon. He asks, do you think History Channel screwed over James Fox? It appears they are not playing his movie at all.
I know James was upset. I talked to James just a couple of days ago, and he was a little upset that that they didn't promote the release of the DVD. They have played the movie a few times. The last time it was, in fact, it was on not too long ago, although, and I watched the History Channel quite often, I did not see any ads for it. That probably upset him. I know he wasn't happy with the, you know, they didn't make a big deal about the release of the DVD, so, you know, there's a group of us trying to spread the word. Excuse me. But, you know, in terms of just getting going with the History Channel to begin with, you know, he had investors. He needed to get something going. He needed to get that, you know, get it out, get it published, and he went with the History Channel. Initially, I thought they did a good job with it. I mean, obviously, from our point of view, we'd love to see it, you know, as much attention as possible given to it.
Definitely.
You know, makes me think of the, you know, the Larry King show the other night when they had Kaku on there and talking about the Hawking statement, which I was so disappointed with the Larry King episode. Yeah, it was you know, they had, and God bless Dan Aykroyd. I mean, I certainly appreciate everything he does for ufology, but he was not to have the person on there with Shostak and Kaku and the other astronomer. It just, I almost turned it off. It was just terrible. He did not. This is another prime example of how not to represent ufology. I was very disappointed with that show. In fact, actually, quite frankly, Kaku did more for ufology in that episode than Aykroyd did. And of course, Aykroyd his position was pro UFO. But anyway.
Well, then it sounds like I didn't miss much, unfortunately. Yeah. I missed that Larry King Live. I whenever he has anything UFO related, I usually do watch it.
Yeah. I get a laugh
out of the debunkers. I think their excuses and explanations are so laughable that it's better than watching Comedy Central.
Well, and that's generally the case. Shostak, for the most part, well, he didn't, you know, Aykroyd really, actually Aykroyd made Shostak and company look good. Kaku, of course, I have the utmost respect for, and he came to the defense of ufology in one particular instance, because he said, you look, he went to a 95.5% ratio of unknowns, and he says, I got to tell you, Larry, that 5% of these unknowns, there's something to this. We don't know what that is. He says it could be, they could be explained with further investigation. He says, but at this point in time, there is this 5% that you know, that is technically a UFO, you know, in the verbatim.
Except for the actual meaning of the acronym UFO, unidentified flying object. You don't know what it is. It's unidentified.
And that's exactly how I always use it, and that's exactly, I'm oftentimes reminding people that the term UFO was born in 1952 by the Air Force. It is an Air Force term. And you know, people forget that. They use the acronym to as a label for an alien spaceship. That is not the case. It's unidentified. If it was an alien spaceship, we'd know what it is. Henceforth, it couldn't be a UFO. If you catch my drift.
Oh, exactly. Personally, I like the term anonymous aeroform. Anomalous aeroform.
That's a very good description. That kind of that narrows it down to almost a nuts and bolts craft in my mind, opposed to just aerial phenomena, which widens it, which could be, you know, atmospheric events or that kind of thing. So, but an aeroform is more defined and narrows it down a little bit. I like that. Yeah.
It's like you said. The nuts and bolts object. You know, I don't see them as being ethereal beings or whatever, or supernatural, paranormal. Take your pick. You know, these objects are solid. They have mass. They move in ways that our technology can't duplicate. They have to be built by someone or something, take your pick, and operated.
This is why I always, if asked, or oftentimes when I'm not asked, it reminds me, I think it was the second or third time that James Fox was on the Larry King show with the regular debunkers, and I emailed him on his BlackBerry right before he went on, and I said, James, do yourself a favor and do not get into the alien confederation and this and that and the other. You know, you've got an hour show, and by the time you take the commercials out of it, let's just round it down to 45 minutes. You've got six people on the show, six puppies at the food dish that are all going to try to put their two cents in. There's no way that you can adequately explain the ETH. Stick with UFOs, because everybody, and debunkers included, are in agreement with UFOs. There's no argument about UFOs. It's an Air Force term. It was born by the Air Force in 52. UFOs are a fact of life. Don't go past that. And he didn't. And what happened was, I think McGaha was on there, and Shermer may have been on there. Well, these guys went to their regular playbook. Their regular debunker playbook, and because James wasn't making that argument, they looked like idiots. You know, they pulled up, they got ahead of themselves, and James says, wait a minute, I'm not talking about aliens. He says, I'm talking about unidentified flying objects that exhibit behavior and characteristics that are far beyond anything that we have in our inventory. Now, I'm not telling you who's driving it. I'm just giving you the facts of life. And the facts as they are after investigation, and this warrants further research. Well, of course, Shermer and McGaha, or whoever the standard debunkers were at the time, they had nowhere to go. You know, they couldn't. All they could do was agree with the fact. You know, all of us are aware of the fact that UFOs exist. That was established back during the Second World War. You know, unidentified flying object, and I had to laugh. The show ended, and he texted me back, you know, at the end of the show, and he said, how'd I do? And I said, you did great. You know, you made these guys look like idiots.
Well, a lot of them do that on their own anyway.
Well, that's true.
It doesn't take much help.
This is true.
You know, you mentioned, too, that they were established as unidentified objects back in World War II. I think it's kind of interesting that during the Foo Fighter incidents of World War II were investigated by Robertson, who went on to head the Robertson panel. It just fascinated me that here was someone who was sent to go investigate an unknown, you know, flying, you know, around our aircraft on both the European theater and the Pacific theater, and nobody knew who they belonged to, and they're thinking it was the other side. You know, and then, bang, a few years later, the guy's heading up the Robertson panel. And some of the individuals that were on the Robertson panel were there with him investigating these objects.
You know, and of course, the CIC. Now, I don't know if Robertson did his investigation under the auspice of the Counterintelligence Corps, but the Counterintelligence Corps did a boatload of investigation on Foo Fighters, and the majority of that, of course, has never seen the light of day. You know, there's a tremendous amount of investigation that was, in fact, done. And bear in mind, the first Foo Fighters, to the best of my knowledge, were reported in 1942. So there was years of investigation on this. And to the best of my knowledge, you know, 99.9% of that has never seen the light of day. You know, and then, of course, then we go from that was towards the end of the war, or I mean, all through the war, the end of the war, then we have the ghost rockets of 46, and then we have what we deem modern day ufology in 47. But yeah, I'd certainly love to see more information on investigations of the Foo Fighters. And remember, too, that, you know, this goes back to what we could call the orb phenomenon. Because many of these Foo Fighters were described as silver balls. Some, there were disc reports cited in this.
Some of them were even little discs. They said some of the pilots reported being the size of about a silver dollar.
You know, fascinating stuff. Very fascinating stuff.
I can, for anybody who's interested in the Foo Fighter phenomenon, I can suggest the best book I found on the subject by Keith Chester called Strange Company. Very informative book. The gentleman spent 12 years in the National Archives, or excuse me, 8 years in the National Archives and interviewed 12 pilots who encountered these things. And out of those 12, there's only like two or three left.
Now, that was published just recently, wasn't it? And I say recently, the last year or two, if I'm not mistaken.
About a year or two, yes.
Yeah.
Great book.
Yeah, I have not read that. I'm glad you brought that up. That's on my want list.
Oh, good gosh. If you were here, I'd say, here, I'll loan you my copy, but I want it back. Oh gosh, yes, interesting book. And kind of moving along here. Oh gosh, a month or two ago, on a radio program. Oh gosh, let me bring it up again. It was a three-hour-long program. But if you listen through it through the archives, you can kind of skip through all the little commercials and do it in about 2 hours and a half, 2 hours 45, something like that. That was a debate, I guess you could call it, on the Rendlesham Forest incident. Here it is. It was on Behind the Paranormal radio broadcast on a CBS Radio East, I believe they call it. Okay, David's wanting me to give him the link so he can post it in the room, in the virtual auditorium. I'm here multitasking, clicking on the computer and all that. Here we go. And they had Halt and Larry Warren and Peter Robbins, Nick Pope, Burroughs and Bill Burns and a few other people here, you know, all together talking about what happened there. And one individual called in who was head of the security for the weapons storage area. Coming in. By chance, did you get a chance to hear that?
I did not. No, I glanced at it when you sent me the link earlier today. I didn't get a chance to listen to it, no. But Rendlesham, I will say this, in my mind, is you know, if you had to pick the top five cases of all time, that certainly is one of them.
Oh, I have to agree. Having met, got to be pretty good friends with Peter Robbins, and through him have met Larry Warren. And then here at, it was the Crash Retrieval Conference this last November. Jim Burrows was there, and with Linda Moulton Howe. And what she brought out has really surprised me on different aspects of the Rendlesham Forest incident. Burrows is now saying that there is a possibility that he was taken on board a craft during their encounter, so to speak.
Interesting. I have not heard that.
Oh, really?
Gosh.
Yeah. I've got that.
It kind of kicks it up to a whole new level.
Oh, it does. It does. And Peniston, Jim Peniston, he's the sergeant that took the crew out on the very first night of the incident. It was Peniston and Burrows and, for the life of me, I can't think of the third man. For those who are unaware of it, but Peniston was the one that took the notes describing, you know, what he was seeing, you know, describing the object.
Right.
And
Peniston was the one that touched it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He said it felt like glass almost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like running your hand across a mirror, and that there were symbols and stuff moving across the surface of this thing, not just the symbols that he jotted down in his notebook that were seemed to be etched into this material. But now Peniston and Burrows are now saying that they are plagued by horrible nightmares of that night, which that's all they won't go into detail yet, but that's pretty much the deal. The one thing that disturbs me about what's going on with Burrows is he's now going through hypnosis sessions. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's doing the sessions, but personally, in my opinion, that just destroys his case right there. I am very much against hypnosis for bringing out memories.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion on the hypnosis end of it?
I think it depends on who's doing it, how it's done. It's a sticky wicket. The arguments are is that oftentimes witnesses are led. That memories can be instilled opposed to dragging a memory out. Memories can actually be input depending on how the session is being handled. It has to be done obviously with somebody that knows what they're doing, and done with extreme caution. Oftentimes, and I've had hypnotists tell me this, that one can do self-hypnosis if they're having problems with memories, if it's a memory issue, that a particular witness or whatnot can almost do kind of a meditation kind of thing, but they can try doing a little self-hypnosis or meditation to try to evoke that memory. And, in many cases, you can take and then walk back through the events, just like you would if you're looking for something. I mean, just think, it's not rocket science in the sense, if you've misplaced something, what do? You go back through your mind's eye and you go, all right, what was I doing before I, when was the last time I saw this object? And you retrace your steps. The same thing can be done to trigger memories like that. Well, it makes me think of the family of the psychologist, the Witnesses of the Phoenix Lights. The name escapes me at the moment, but they actually had memory loss. They saw the large craft as a family unit, up close and personal, forgot about it, which, by the way, was a common theme with many witnesses, which is another, that's a phenomena under the phenomena of the Phoenix Lights that often doesn't get talked about. And then they saw something on the news days later, and it triggered the memory. And all of them remembered it as a family unit again. And this guy's a psychologist, by the way, very respectable people, good witnesses. And then the question was, why... my God, this was a big event. This was really something that we saw. Why didn't we talk about it? And they just forgot about it. But my point being in this instance is that that whatever happened on the news, that triggered the memory. You can do the same thing, and I'm not totally against hypnosis, but if, for those that are, or if you were a little apprehensive to do a session, you could, oftentimes you can trigger a memory by doing that. You know, going back through and reliving it. Now, if it's a traumatic event, a post-traumatic event from the war or something like that, oftentimes your subconscious is protecting you, and in those instances, it's going to be harder. And you may not want to do that by yourself, or an individual may not want to be alone, and that kind of thing, because it's a self protection mechanism that your mind's doing if it was in fact an extreme event that happened, a military thing or a very negative abduction or that kind of thing. But I'm not against hypnosis entirely, but it is a sticky wicket. You're getting into a gray area oftentimes, particularly if it's with somebody that doesn't know what they're doing.
Definitely. Okay. This is from Instant Karma, and he asks, are you familiar with the whole David Jacobs, Emma Woods thing?
I am mildly. Karma, do you have specifics you're talking about? Is there a specific... Or can you just frame the question generally?
Okay, we'll give him some time to pound the keys and get that out there.
Sure.
This is in particular, the questionable regressions.
I don't know enough to make an intelligent retort with that, other than to say, again, we go back... I know people, and it, this gets out my gets out of my safety zone, but I know people that regression of past lives and this kind of thing. And as a researcher, I have to go where evidence takes me. And if somebody was regressed and they're coming up with the memory that they didn't retain before, if they didn't have that for example, in this instance, let's say that one of the Rendlesham witnesses, which of course has come to light, that the individual was taken on a craft. Okay, I'm going to need corroborating evidence to that. Now, that doesn't mean I will disbelieve the anecdotal evidence or that I would disbelieve the hypnosis that evoked that memory, but I'm going to be skeptical. And I need to see more evidence, but that's how I operate anyway as a researcher, as any researcher does. If one sliver of evidence comes up, then the next thing we need is corroborating evidence. If one witness comes up, the next thing we want is another witness at the very least, and then let's depending on the circumstance, you look for physical evidence or any other collateral evidence that might be there in a given case.
From what I understand, for Burroughs, the third guy that, for the life of me, I can't think of his name, said he saw Burroughs going up a shaft of light.
And we have Burroughs claiming that he
He claims he doesn't remember it.
That he doesn't remember it. So he was the one that possibly was on a craft, and then we have a second witness saying he was going up a shaft.
And Tennyson says that one moment Burroughs was right next to him, and the next he wasn't.
That is intriguing. It's not enough, but it's intriguing. You have to look at these. I've watched interviews and actually corresponded with one or two of these gentlemen, and I know them to be sound, sober witnesses. So when sound, sober people make statements like that, and you do have somewhat of a corroboration between the three, it gives me pause, and which means we have to look further. You know, we've got to look into this further. What else went on? Is there any other evidence that we can obtain under those circumstances? And it just fascinates the hell out of me, quite frankly.
Oh, I agree. From what I understand, Linda Howe and Burroughs are at the X conference this weekend, and I would love to hear any updates on the investigation on what's been going on with Jim is presented at that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we're going to hear something soon, shortly after the X conference.
Oh, definitely.
Linda will share something, I'm certain.
Well, if nothing else, I can go onto the X conference website and get the DVD of that presentation and kind of compare it to the one that they gave at Crash Conference. Here's another question from Skymon. He would like to know, what is next for UFO Chronicles? What have you always wanted to do?
Well, that's an easy question. We are working on a radio show and trying to put that together. Behind the game with everything that's always going on, but that's in front of us to do a UFO Chronicles radio show. We're excited about that and lend our voice to the podcast sphere, so to speak. I'm real excited about that. One of the other things that's always ongoing is that one of the things that happened a long time ago with the UFO Chronicles, because there's always something going on in ufology at any given moment, it's extremely difficult to keep up with it all. So what I did is I installed various script to make sure that we never missed any UFO news. So literally, as news becomes available on the net, it automatically appears at the UFO Chronicles. And that kind of took a lot of the burden off and made it, to where we wouldn't miss anything. And we could focus on certain things and or articles or what have you that would go in the main body of the site without missing anything, on the sidebars. And that's ever expanding. We're always adding different geographical areas in the world. For example, recently we just added Australia, specific, strictly Australian UFO news. And we're always adding to that. And then we also add different writers to our posse, as I like to call it. We've always published, for example, Anthony Bregaglia's articles, and recently I gave him a column at the UFO Chronicles, so all of his various articles will appear there, and so forth, and that part always goes on. But the biggest thing, I think, is the radio section that we're trying to establish, and hopefully we'll get that done soon.
Personally, I think you would do wonderful with your own program. You've got the enthusiasm, you've got the knowledge, and boy, have you got the voice for it.
Well, thank you, Dee. I certainly appreciate that. And of course, it will be syndicated right here at the UPRN network, so everybody will be able to listen to it here as well.
Fantastic. Yeah. You got to hook up with... Joe Montalvo there in New Orleans and get yourself started, guy.
Well, he and I have discussed it, basically what's going to go on. I'm a control freak, and you know, I've got to produce things a certain way and so forth and so on. So I told Joe, I says, you know, when all of this gets done, we'll certainly have it syndicated here at UPRN. That's no problem. Joe's been very good to me, so. And I appreciate your compliments.
And on that note, we need to go to a break, and we'll be back here in 8 to 9 minutes here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network with more of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Frank Warren. Frank, one of the things I meant to mention while we were still on the subject of UFO conferences, Hastings and Salas is trying to put together a conference of at the press club in D.C. A gathering of individuals who are involved with UFO encounters with nuclear weapons and where they're stored, or like Malmstrom, where the missile silos and whatnot.
Well, Robert and Bob Salas, they're going to. This is a perfect example. Here, they're going to gather up some of the best witnesses possible, 99.9% military, that were in the position of handling or working at nuclear weapons facilities. So in terms of the caliber of people in regards to witnesses, this is la creme de la creme. These are the types of conferences that we need. And, of course, most of our listeners are familiar with Robert Hastings' work. And this is something that I'm really looking forward to. And my hat is off to both Robert and Bob Salas in doing this. These are the kind of things that we really need to focus on. And for those that are listening, they need our help. It costs money to put these things together. It costs money to, if you don't believe that, just ask James Fox, to fly witnesses in. You've got to house them. You've got to feed them, so forth and so on. These things aren't cheap, and these guys aren't made of money. You know, they in essence are doing this, basically as a public service. Somebody, I was reading a comment, Billy Cox wrote a piece on the efforts of Hastings and Salas, and somebody made a little comment in his comments section at the Devoid blog, and like, oh my God, I smell a rat, you know, they're trying to do this for money, and I thought, my God, you know, how many people, if you think there's money in ufology and you think that these people are trying to do this for money, you better wake up and smell the coffee. You know, it's a losing. Well, in fact, you want to talk to somebody else. Talk to Stephen Bassett this weekend after this weekend's conference and see how much money he made. He'll be running out of red ink real fast. But I'm really, really excited. And you made me think of Hastings when you brought up Rendlesham. And these are the things that people forget. You forget the nuclear aspect of the Rendlesham case, and then also, from the what we call the birth of modern day ufology in 47, focused sightings in the summer of 47 at all of these areas that were nuclear related. For example, Hanford, Oak Ridge, Savannah, Georgia, Roswell, New Mexico. And by the way, people forget that the night of the Roswell crash, there were witnesses of objects over Roswell, and later there were, not associated with the crash, there were other sightings over Roswell. So all of these nuclear-related sites were visited. There were sightings of UFOs in the summer of 47, which is a big commonality and fascinating that these... that UFOs attracted, for lack of a better description, to these particular sites.
Oh, and then not only can you donate money to the bringing this together, they are also willing, you know, if you've got some frequent flyer miles that you can donate to fly these individuals in for this, they would be more than happy to do it that way. And also, any monies that are left over after this conference is done will be donated to charity. So that right there is telling you they're not making any off of this.
Precisely. And there's always one or two bad apples. That was, most everybody understands that. And particularly anybody that knows Rob Hastings or Bob Salas in any form or fashion is aware of that. And I'm sure it's going to be successful. But yeah, we do need all the help that's out there. This is certainly a worthy cause, and it's going to be unprecedented in regards to the witnesses that they bring to the table. I mean, anybody that's familiar with Hastings' work and he's interviewed over 100 different witnesses. Many that were former what we call missileers. It's going to be exciting stuff.
Oh, well, I put it up there with the press conference that Leslie Kane and James Fox did with all the pilots.
Precisely.
Exactly. The Iranian pilot, the English pilot, the French pilot, the... was it Brazilian pilot? Pilots from all over the planet, not just the United States.
The impact is going to be the same, and that I agree. Yeah. It's going to be heavy duty stuff.
Okay, and for those who'd like to donate to that, the website to go to is www.ufohastings.com/presspage.html, and at the bottom of the page is a donate button. They have a PayPal deal going there, and gosh, guys, even if you can only do like $5, every little bit helps. Yes, and as I said, everything that's left over goes to a nonprofit organization. So this is well worth helping these two gentlemen get out or get this information out there. That as late as last year was another incident over if I remember correctly, it was a storage facility for nuclear weapons.
We had.
I'm wrong on that.
We had a witness that contacted us through the My UFO Experience portal at the UFO Chronicles, who was a guard at a nuclear weapons facility in Germany, who shared his up-close and personal UFO experience. In fact, I actually connected him to Robert so he could add the that declaration and that report to the totality, you know, to the preponderance of all of his reports. But that was fascinating. And that, if you go to the UFO Chronicles site and search nuclear weapons sites and keyword UFO, you should be able to find that. And My UFO Experience. But, in fact, there's a lot of we do have archived a lot of the newspaper accounts with UFO sightings at various Nike sites and missile bases. There, if you do a search there, some of the archived newspaper reports from the 60s and whatnot. It's fascinating stuff. And a lot of it, well, in addition to that, we also have some Blue Book reports from some of the same sightings. If you search the site, it's just you know, for those of us that are into historic UFO cases, it, you know, you could spend hours searching that stuff.
Oh, that's for sure. That's definitely for sure. You know what else I'd like to see come about, kind of in the same vein, if nothing else, get a bunch of radar operators to come forward.
The well, quite frankly, in this mix of witnesses, I'm certain some of those will be radar operators. And of course, that's how Robert Hastings got hooked to begin with. You know, his dad was Air Force, and he happened to be up in a radar tower as a teenager. He had a job, you know, cleaning. And there happened to be a UFO sighting, and one of the radar operator pulled him over and said, "Hey, kid, look at this." And he actually, his first experience as a young teenager was witnessing UFOs at an Air Force base on the radar screen. And then when things heated up a little bit, they scuttled him out of there. And a couple days later, he saw that radar operator again, and it said, "So what was that? What was going on?" And I guess the event was so serious that the radar operator couldn't talk about it, nor did his dad, as I recall.
This is true. I had him on here recently talking about this conference, and he started off by telling the story of what happened. And every time I hear it, I find it very fascinating.
Well, and the irony, you know, the irony with that, Dee, is so often is the case where somebody either has an experience, and oftentimes it's you know, not necessarily a sighting of their own. It's just a major event where you get hooked. You know, Angela is a prime example. Although she wasn't a direct witness at the time, she was neck deep with Stephenville, and it's literally changed her life. Of course, she has since become a witness with the Oregon Bob investigation. But, you know, one point I wanted, Skyman was asking about what's next for the UFO Chronicles. One thing I wanted to add to that is it's important to note that the UFO Chronicles is the website. It's a researcher's website. So I'm always involved in various research in different cases across the board, opposed to just, you know, opposed to just being a website on UFO phenomenon. I mean, it is a researcher's website. But anyway, back to, you know, people in, or individuals that have had experiences. And, of course, it's just amplified when somebody does have an up-close and personal UFO sighting. You know, we all want to know what's going on. What is that? So in many cases, it just changes the person's life. You know, Angela is a prime example. Mike Fortson comes to mind. Many of the eyewitnesses to the large craft that flew over the state of Arizona that we now call the Phoenix Lights comes to mind. You know, anybody, of course, the Rendlesham witnesses, another prime example. It literally has affected their life, and they're neck deep in it.
Oh, yes, most definitely. And it's it completely changed their lives too.
It certainly has, yeah.
I have another question from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Gossamer. He says, Frank, you being a researcher and a California resident, I am wondering if you hear from people who have had sightings in the area of California that has been nicknamed Triangle Alley.
You know, I don't know if this is the same place, but because of what's going on with the Oregon Bob case, there are, I have heard from, for years now, with different people that have no connection with each other, of sightings up in the American River Canyon. And words like portal, vortex, and this kind of thing have come up in conversations. This is a span of, say, 20 years where I've heard various rumors and stories and so forth and so on. And I just find that intriguing that here again we have an area in the wilderness where strange phenomenon is reported. And it was very, well, that was reminiscent when in going over the things that's happening with Oregon Bob and in that particular case. Which, by the way, that, as you know, the Oregon Bob case is just fascinating beyond words, and is progressing, I should say, where things are looking as if hopefully we'll be able to do a preliminary investigation here shortly.
I would love to see any of the footage that, and again, I'm really bad with names. But the lady journalist, photojournalist with her cameraman.
That was Jamie McDowell. Yeah.
Thank you. I would love to see any footage that she her cameraman has taken at this area. Is any of that going to be made available, online?
There's actually a lot of footage. Bob is in possession of footage. I'm in possession of some footage that Bob has given me to analyze, and we've got some other footage that is going to be analyzed shortly. But here again, we have the preponderance of evidence. The synopsis of what went on with Bob, bear in mind that with Bob's experiences at the time, what was in the media back at the moment when Bob was trying to figure out what to do and who to reach out to, this is back when Stephenville was going on hot and heavy, and Angela and Steve Allen and whatnot were being interviewed by everybody at that point in time. And this is when he reached out to Angela and Steve Allen and that group, flew to Texas and made a presentation. The presentation was convincing enough for that group to draw straws and send somebody back to do a quickie investigation. And of course that was Angela, and then Randall, her husband, wasn't going to let her go by herself, so they went together as a team and they had their own experience, which has been the case with Bob. Every time he has taken somebody out, he's batting 1,000. And of course we now, when we jointly made the decision for Bob to go public, the first interview was done with Jamie McDowell, who, as you know, is a very credible witness with a very high-caliber resume. And that was followed by Jack Peters. Same can be said for Jack, very good, sober witness, of good character, etc. And then we did the show with Angela and Randall and had them recount their event. In that show, and then the second half of that show is when we brought Bob and introduced him to the world for the first time publicly. And then the very last show we did another show with Bob and then brought Nathan on, which was another direct eyewitness that has been going out with Bob for years now. And he had very similar stories to tell as Bob did. So that's what? That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's 6 witnesses that have come together you know, in terms of shoring up the account, and they've all had individual experiences. Well, and then, by the way, Nathan took his mother out, you know, because everybody's thinking, as we said in one of the shows, there's so many things going on. I mean, I was brought into this as a ufologist, but, and I hate to use the word paranormal, but it, quite frankly, is the only way you can describe it. There's just so many things going on. Orb phenomena. Angela and Randall witnessed what they describe as a metallic craft on the ground. There have been reports of beings up close and personal. The orb phenomenon. There has been, well, quite frankly, there's been missing time reported. There's also the equipment has been affected. It just goes on and on. I mean, it is absolutely mind-boggling. It's something is going on in the forest of Oregon, and it necessitates further research, to put it mildly.
There's a comment that was made in the virtual auditorium by Linda Keeper that would be funny if it was for the fact that this kind of stuff has happened before. And she commented saying, wonder if MUFON will try to take the Oregon Bob case from Angela, too.
That we don't have to worry about. The, you know, before this went public, and of course Angela was the one that contacted me and brought me into the fray, but this has been going on now for, I think, over 2 years. So, and Bob has become a good friend and whatnot. We kind of look out for Bob, and we don't have to worry about anything. A plan has basically been put in place, and things are starting to look as if it's coming together to do a proper at the very least there'll be a preliminary investigation and then hopefully one more suitable after the preliminary investigation. So things are, they look as if they're falling into place, but we'll know more as we go along.
Oh, we'll have to keep this all posted on what's going on.
Oh, you bet. It's exciting stuff. It's very exciting stuff.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. Any new cases that come about that are of a continuing nature, such as the Oregon Bob case or even the Hudson Valley case of these objects being seen all over the place. This Oregon Bob thing, it seems to be in one specific location, not just a little bit over here, a little bit over there.
No, actually, there are several locations. It's not in one specific location. And this I'm going to just call it this phenomena does move. And bear in mind, Bob and company, they've been at this for years, and Bob has gotten pretty good at being able to track the phenomena, for lack of a better description. He's aware of multiple locations where the phenomena occurs, and again, he's batting 1,000. There's, to the best of my knowledge, there's nobody that has gone up there and given him the time that he stated that hasn't had some sort of experience, and Angela and Randall included. I mean, you know, as if you remember listening to Angela's narrative when I was interviewing her and Randall, she pretty much had given up. You know, they were in their third day; they could only spend 3 days there, and she thought, well, you know, she one thing had come up about luminescent fungi. And she, in fact, thought that perhaps was one of the things Bob was seeing. And, you know, she didn't. She thought, well, you know, maybe this can all be explained. And then the third night they had their sighting, you know, up close and personal and on the ground, which appeared to them to be a metallic craft. Well, that's set the hook, so to speak. And if you go back and listen to that interview, you can hear it in their voice. And then after I finished interviewing Angela, we passed the mic to Randall, and he just reconfirmed, you know, what she saw. And Randall had to hold Angela back. I mean, she was headed down the hill. And, you know, this is pitch black, you know, down a mountainside, basically. And he said, no. You know, and everybody's adrenaline's pumping. I mean, this is, you know, the real deal going on. And so she went from mainstream journalist that broke the Stephenville story to a direct eyewitness. You know, and quite frankly, this, you know, this happened some time back. This was one of the things that gave me the case. There's so many things going on with this Oregon Bob case that you just think, my God, it's crazy stuff. Because I heard a lot of the details early on, and I thought, my God, what have we got going on here? But one of the things that kept me in it and gave me pause from the very beginning, because I know Angela, and I trust her. In the beginning, I didn't know Bob that well. He's just a person with an anecdote. I've since become friends with him, and I trust his character and trust what he says. But at the time, I didn't know. I just got my researcher's hat on. But I do put faith in Angela and her husband, and I know what they were. I know they were telling me the truth in regards to what they saw. That's what gave me pause as we were investigating the case. And of course, since that time, we've just added to the witness count, and we've become more familiar with other evidence that's involved in the case. And what I say as a researcher, without a shadow of a doubt, something very strange is going on in the forests of Oregon, and it deserves our attention. And it looks as if it's going to get our attention here, hopefully in the next couple of months.
You know, if that would have been David and I down there that night, there'd have been no way in hell David would have stopped me from going on down that hill.
Well, I think it took everything for Randall to hold her back, and quite frankly, that was a smart thing to do. You know, you don't know what you're getting into. I mean, I feel the same way as you do. I think, and we've all said that, but of course, it's different when you're there. But I feel the same way. I think, you know, look out, get out of my way, because I'm going to go down there. I'm going to go touch that thing.
I'm taking my camera and a flashlight, and if you don't like it, too bad. If not, we'll follow along.
Yeah. Well, the only reason I wouldn't have forgot the camera is because I would have been wearing one on my side, as I often do. And then that, you know, I think when these things happen, it's like anybody. Everybody always talks about preparation, but when the event, it's just like I always harken back to Mike Fortson and his lovely wife's witnessing of the Phoenix Lights. They were frozen. I mean, you think about all these things until something like this happens, and then they said, you know, we were just frozen. You know, we weren't going anywhere. And the same thing, I mean, you know, in that instance, I know I would have had a camera only because I would have had it on my side. If I'd had the wherewithal to take it out and shoot anything, I don't know. But I certainly would have loved to go down there and try to get as close to this thing as humanly possible, you know. But it's probably, in retrospect, it's probably a good idea that didn't happen under the circumstances.
Well, I can kind of relate to Fortson and his wife, you know, not wanting to take their eyes off of what they were seeing. The first sighting I had, it was like, I mean, I'm standing there watching this thing, and this was a daytime sighting. And I'm standing there watching this thing, and it's slowly moving towards the cloud. And I've got that, oh, dummy, go get your camera. So, of course, you know, the camera was up in the bedroom upstairs. You know, so by the time I ran upstairs, grabbed the camera, took the little, I think it had a 35-millimeter lens off of it, took that lens off, and put a 400-millimeter lens on it, and got back downstairs. And just as I got the stupid thing in focus, it went behind a cloud. Or the only cloud in that half of the sky. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just wait till it comes out the other side. And I waited. And I waited. And that thing never did come out the other side. So it was like, well, did this thing realize I was down there waiting to take its picture, or did it just take off and go east and lift the cloud between us? I don't know, but I can relate on that. You know, it's either the last second you decide to get the camera, Or, you know, in like one other instance, I had a video camera with me. And unfortunately, I hadn't had the camera very long and hadn't had much of a chance to play with it to figure out how to take it off autofocus so that I could manual focus the stupid thing. But still, I got pretty close to 3 minutes of footage of some objects in the sky here in the Phoenix area.
Mm.
So again, it's just a matter of whether you think it, you know, think, go get the camera. Or if you don't have a camera with you, you know, you're stuck between the proverbial rock and a hard place.
You know, let me share this anecdote with you. You made me think of this, but this has been several years ago, but, you know, Stan flew out here and we picked him up at the airport and took him to dinner. And it was just a real quick thing because he was jumping on another flight. So he had a couple of hours and we took him out to dinner and talking turkey for a little while and we're on our way back, or we got out in the parking lot of the restaurant before we were going to take him back to the airport and I had a new digital camera and we shot a bunch of pictures of he and I together and this kind of thing, you know, probably shot six or seven pictures or whatever, and then took him back to the airport, sent him on his way, and I did not know how to operate that camera properly and lost all those photographs. But I just thought that you made me think of that with the camera thing. But you know, the difference, too, between I think it's a difference between having a distant sighting of, you know, an object, you know, far away, opposed to having an up close and personal sighting that is just, you know, beyond anything, beyond description. The only thing, oftentimes in talking to Mike, the only thing I can wrap my brain around in terms of how he may have felt is the first time that I went to the Grand Canyon, because my brain couldn't wrap my brain around this big gash in the ground. I mean, I was looking at it and I was seeing it, but it just, for any of our listeners that have been to the Grand Canyon, you just don't believe it. You know, you go, wow. And so that was the only thing that I think that could even come close to the feeling of what some of the Phoenix Lights witnesses in particular saw of an up-close and personal object, you know, opposed to a UFO at a distance. I mean, I've had a sighting myself, which wasn't that impressive, although it was a UFO in every sense of the word. It wasn't that big of a deal to me. You know, it was a cylindrical-shaped object, silver in color. I'd hate to guess the distance, but my wife and I saw it, and then we got out of the car, and I could see it, and then I went to position, get in a better position. I went under this tree to get on the other side, and it was gone. But that, you know, those kind of sightings for me just, they don't do anything for me. I mean, opposed to an up close, you know, something that would really shake you up. But I can say that I did have my own UFO sighting, and that was several years ago.
No, I have to say all the sightings I've had have been 5 miles or further away.
Yeah.
Roughly, you know, give or take. I've had three and possibly a fourth one. David and I were on our way back here to Glendale from a little town in Idaho called Emmett to visit my mother and other family members. And it was late, well, early morning. We left.
That's not by Pocatello, is it?
Actually, Pocatello is kind of on the eastern side of the lower half of the state. And Emmett is about 30 miles northwest of Boise,
mm-hmm.
which is on the western, southwestern corner of the state.
Oh, that's up there by, whatchamacallit, the real beautiful up there. I can't think of the name of that place, but it's just paradise up there.
Up in the mountains?
Yeah, what is the name of that?
McCall?
No, that's not it. My ex-wife used to live up there. About a year.
There's John Lee, Cascade, McCall, New Meadows, Grangeville, rather. That's all quite a bit north of Emmett. Emmett is about I'd say about 30-minute drive from the timberline in the Payette National Forest.
Well, the name of this place, it's, well, all of that's just absolutely gorgeous up there in any event. It'll come to me here. But.
Yeah, and the geology around there is pretty darn interesting, too, but that's another kettle of fish.
Mm-hmm.
That whole area up there, UFO-wise, is rather active. I've had two sightings there myself, and my sister had a craft fly very low over her car one night, about halfway between town and her house, at the time she lived out in the county. And she said this thing barely cleared the power poles that were alongside the street.
Well, you know, in 1947, there was claimed to be a landing in Idaho. That was reported in the newspapers. I forget the exact town.
There's been a lot of historical-wise. One of the first theodolite sightings through a theodolite, mm-hmm. was at what is now Substation and Main Street there in Emmett. Frank, for posting that. Also, the landed in Idaho. I'll have to copy that and check that out a little later.
This was St. Mary's. Eight flying saucers reported the day to have made a landing in a mountainside near St. Mary's, Idaho, in full view of 10 persons. Now, remember, beginning with Arnold's sighting, you know, we had a group of 8 to 9 saucers reported all over the western United States, including this one, where it was reported that that there was a landing, which I always found fascinating. And then, of course, at times oftentimes in this particular instance they counted 8, and it was around July. Then if you want to take in the Roswell episode, you have one missing opposed to Arnold's sighting earlier. It makes you wonder.
Well, with Kenneth Arnold's sighting, now that you bring that up, there was a gentleman in Boise who was a reporter for the Idaho Statesman newspaper. He happened to be a member of the Air Guard out of Gowan Field. And once he heard Kenneth Arnold's story, he decided, I need to log a few flight hours anyway. He thought, I'll just go ahead and take a P-51 out and log some flight time and keep my eyes open for whatever it was that Arnold saw. Maybe I can see something. And he had like 3 days of his weekend guard deal to do this. And on the third day, it was the end of the day, and he was heading back to the airport and saw something out towards the east of Boise, and there was an airliner off that direction as well. So he contacted the tower and asked for the radio frequency of that aircraft and talked to the pilot, told the pilot of the liner where this object was in relation to the airliner, and the pilot of the airliner confirmed it.
He was also interviewed by Brown and Davidson, by the way, and he did know Kenneth Arnold. If we're speaking of the same individual.
I never did get the guy's name, the reporter's name.
Yeah, he actually played a big role in that. Brown and Davidson went to interview him before they went out and interviewed Kenneth Arnold prior to their death on August 1st, 1947, in the crash of the Mitchell B-25.
Yes. We have one last question here from a virtual auditorium, and I got to ask it because it's a perfect question for having just, let's see, 7 minutes to go in the program. Again, this is from Skymon, and he says, so, where do we go from here in ufology? How do we move the ball forward after all these years? What do we do now?
I think part of the answer is there has to be cohesion, you know, within what we call ufology, number one. And cohesion can start with just MUFON, for example. MUFON needs to act as one body. These, you know, for example, what's going on with state branches and these smaller subgroups, you know, the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing, that all has to stop. You know, MUFON needs to clean house or any group like that. There has to be cohesion. The goals have to be mutual and common. And one of the things that I've said for decades is the biggest problem in ufology is lack of funding. I don't want to pick on MUFON. I have no problems with MUFON per se. It's easy to sit back and criticize things, but remember, for the most part, MUFON is a group of volunteers. And it's just like anything volunteer-based. People have lives. They have to make a living. They have other concerns. Ufology needs proper funding where people get paid for their time and they don't have to worry about making a living and so forth and so on. That would be, in my mind, first and foremost. There has to be funds allocated to do proper research. You know, whether that be creating an entire new entity or restructuring MUFON or another group like it or what have you, I think that would be a first good step. I mean, if you go back to the early days of NICAP, you had heavy hitters involved in that. You had the first head of the CIA, Roscoe Hillenkoetter was in NICAP. You had all of these military heads that were involved in the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Can you imagine if we had the same caliber of people today in a group that was well financed? The giggle factor would not even wouldn't be a factor if that were the case today. Ufology is its own worst enemy. You know, in part, underfunding or no funding, and then creating some of these circus atmospheres that we tend to do. Those would be the first two things to get the ball rolling. To be taken seriously. Ufology needs an agent. We have to be careful how we present things. Otherwise we're never, the subject matter doesn't get taken seriously. It just ends up being the butt of jokes. I mean, let's face it, for those of us that do pay attention to these things, how often do you see mainstream media, like your local television program, if they report that there's a sighting nearby and whatnot, how often do you see one where there isn't a poke in the ribs or the guffaws or the wink, wink, nod, nods?
X-Files theme song.
Sure, or the Star Trek music, the lights flipping off and on. It's a rarity that happens because they don't take the subject matter seriously, and the reason for that, for the most part, it's our own fault. It's how we present the information, and we need to stop shooting ourselves in the foot. That would in part be one way to move forward, I think.
Oh, Gossamer just came up with a good follow-up, or David, my husband, come up with another good follow-up question to this. This is, do you think some in ufology are still coming at this as if they have to convince people or prove the phenomenon is even real?
Yeah, well, you know, that's actually a good observation, and that oftentimes is the case. People forget, you know, first off, there is, it always bothers me when people associate the verb believe or the noun believer with UFO. UFOs are a fact of life. So for us to regurgitate the argument and try to argue that UFOs are real or you believe in UFOs, look, that was solved 60 years ago. Get past that. We, you know, the argument is, are some UFOs of extraterrestrial origin? That's the question. That question is above and beyond the existence of UFOs. The existence of UFOs is a fact. For a person or a ufologist or even a UFO enthusiast to pose that question, again, that's part of shooting yourself in the foot. We're way beyond that. And this is why I always say we have to go in baby steps, because we almost always have to re-educate the audience at the time that, look, there's no argument about UFOs. They're a fact of life. They've been here for throughout man's history, quite frankly. They're here today. They'll be here tomorrow. They don't go away. The question is, what are they? You know, and so for someone to make the argument, you know, the phenomenon is real, it's like, look, we're way past that. Don't even bring that up. It just irritates the hell out of me when that happens, you know.
Oh, definitely. Oh, David's over here commenting on it to me, and I'm like, I can barely even hear him. I've got an earplug in one ear and my headset in the other. Well, unfortunately, Frank, we have run out of time.
Two hours have gone by that quick. Which is a phenomenon unto itself here on the Eye to the Sky show. Somehow we have missing time. I mean, the time just goes by. There's something going on here, Dee.
It just never seems to be enough time, does it?
It never
just
does.
Get the ball rolling.
Yeah,
get the momentum going, and we run out of time. Darn it. Well, Frank, we're definitely going to have you back on, and if nothing else, just, you know, get updates on the Oregon Bob case.
Lots of stuff going on. Well, which, by the way, we didn't get to Aztec. We have uncovered a boatload of new evidence into the old case of 1948, the Aztec incident, the crash in Aztec. There is some mind-boggling stuff that has come to light just recently in that, but we'll have to save that for another show, it looks like.
Oh, gosh, I wish I'd have known that. Well, you got into it. But unfortunately, we got to clear the air for the next program coming up. And thanks again, Frank. I really enjoyed this a lot.
Well, thanks for having me, and back at you, Dee. And I'd like to just say thank you to our audience and all of our listeners and everybody in the V-Room that participated. And another big shout-out to the city of New Orleans.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, tonight guest hosted by Jason Wilson. Please join us again next Saturday for Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.